Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, November 9th, 2023. This is our third case set for oral argument. It is A21-1672, State of Minnesota versus Wade Scott Reinhard. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by the state, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. The podium you can lower and raise to adjust for height, and also the microphone. There is a timer on the podium as well. Please be mindful of that so you stay within your time frame. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Barry Edwards. I'm with the Keller Law Offices, and I represent appellant Wade Reinhard in this matter. Mr. Reinhard raised some issues that speak to whether justice was served in this case. And it's not my job, and with due respect, it's not your job, nor the district court's job, to say, meh. It's the district court's job to look at whether, if the facts are presumed, read in the light most favorable to the person in Mr. Reinhardt's position, that is, petitioner in the post-conviction relief matter, if those facts are read in the light most favorable to him, then has he established by a fair preponderance of the evidence, and I admit I don't know what the word fair is doing in that phrase, but it's always there, that maybe justice wasn't done and we should have a hearing here. And Mr. Reinhard cleared that hurdle. He met that burden.
How did he do that?
I'm glad you asked, because it's right here on my notes. Mr. Reinhard raised at least two interesting, compelling issues. And I think there are more, but there are two big ones. The 800-pound gorilla, or whatever is a big gorilla, I'm not sure if 800 is big or small, is the letter. The letter trial counsel allegedly sent to Mr. Reinhard.
Allegedly? I think that is part of the record, right?
Well, counsel raised, opposing appellate counsel here, raised in her brief the question that Mr. Reinhardt's affidavit in support of his post-conviction petition, that's a lot of P's, that Mr. Reinhardt raised in support of his post-conviction petition that he sees that Mr. Reinhardt seems to be suggesting maybe that signature is forged. I did not make that allegation. As far as I recall, and I looked at the affidavit again this morning, Mr. Reinhardt did not make that allegation, but it occurred to counsel. And the fact that it occurred to counsel, to my mind, raises a fact question of sufficient force that the district court should have at least had a hearing to address it.
Do you dispute it? The veracity of that letter?
I do not dispute the veracity of that letter.
Okay.
Personally, but I don't think that my personal opinion is particularly relevant or interesting, and I get told that a lot. The other issue is the medication that Mr. Reinhardt was on. I'll give it a go. Olanzapine, I believe, is what it's called. It's in the briefs. And I guess
He said at the hearing it's not affecting him, right?
He did.
So isn't that the end of it? I mean, he admits he was on medication. He admits that it wasn't affecting him. I mean, what more do you want the district court to do?
I have two, now maybe three responses to that. One is, if one is impaired by a antipsychotic medication, then one might not know one is impaired. And that may create an impossible burden for the district court.
But, many psychotic conditions are controlled by medication. I mean, is there anything in the record that indicate, he was frothing at the mouth or running around the room so that the medication wasn't working?
I'm not suggesting that Mr. Reinhart was experiencing the psychosis that the medicine was prescribed for. I'm suggesting that he suggested that the medication caused the medication itself while addressing the
Once he said he was on medication, and once the district said, okay, but you still understand what's going on, you know, my words, not the district court's, and he said yes, what more should the district court have done at that point? Adjourned so that, you know, we can, you know, get a doctor in to examine him? I mean, what more, you know, this happened, you know, lots of people in court are under medication, and lots of people, despite the fact they're under medication, answer that it's not affecting their ability to understand rationally what's going on and making a knowing and voluntary and intelligent plea. So what should the district court have done at this point once he said, I'm fine, it's not affecting me? What should the court have done at that point?
To be clear, for today's purposes, I'm arguing what the district court should do on the post-conviction relief matter, but I will address the court's question, which is, if someone said, yeah, I'm drunk, but I'm fine, what would the court do?
I stop the hearing. But
right.
If someone said,
or I'm on
I've
marijuana.
Had a drink 2 hours ago, but it's not affecting my ability to think clearly and I understand what's going on, I think that's different. And I think that's closer to this case than saying I'm drunk. You know. Because then if you're saying you're drunk, then clearly you don't know what's going on. That's why you're drunk.
Well, I don't know how far we want to spin out the hypotheticals, but what if instead of I'm drunk or I had a beer 2 hours ago, he said I had 2 beers before I came into court? The point at which I don't think the district court judge is going to have a good opinion on whether the person is of sufficiently clear mind to waive constitutional rights.
Getting back to your original point, the issue here is whether or not the post-conviction court abused its discretion by denying an evidentiary hearing based on the facts that were alleged, viewing them in light most favorable to appellant.
Right.
In this case, appellant said the medication affected me, but the post-conviction court also had the transcript from the hearing at which appellant said that the medication had no bearing whatsoever on his ability to perceive what's going on today. And when the district court directly asked appellant about whether the medication affected his ability to understand the proceedings or to make an informed decision or choice, he responded, quote, no, it does not. So these were not just yes or no responses. These were clearly articulated responses. So why did the post-conviction court, just based on the affidavit of saying the medication he was on affected his ability, and the transcript clearly indicates otherwise, in addition to those statements, why is that an abuse of discretion? I mean, and let me ask one additional question. Sorry to have compound questions, but did he present anything saying this particular medication has a profound effect on your ability to think, to be rational, to understand the proceedings? Was there anything other than just the affidavit by appellant to support that particular claim?
I think that would be the purpose of the post-conviction relief hearing, is to flesh out that record. One of the reasons, one of the primary reasons this court asks people who are dissatisfied with the district court outcome to pursue post-conviction remedies before coming here is to get a full record. Mr. Reinhart is not a medical doctor. In fact, it appears from the record that he suffers from multiple mental illnesses, including psychosis. He would not be the person from whom I would expect to get that information.
Well, couldn't you just say, okay, here's a picture of my medication that I'm on. Here are the side effects. I mean, information is fairly readily available, including on the medication and the statement of what it is, what side effects it can cause. I mean, there wasn't anything to say this could indeed cause, somebody to not, don't drive, motorized vehicles or something
heavy
like
machinery.
That. Yeah, to at least to be able to get over that threshold, to be able to get an evidentiary hearing.
Well, maybe I'm hearing from this court that petitions for post-conviction relief and affidavits accompanying those positions should themselves be more thorough. It's been my opinion, given the way Minnesota Statute 590 in general is written, and especially I think it's 04 and 02, that it's almost notice pleading. That's too far. But given that the burden is a preponderance of the evidence in the light most favorable to petitioner, I think once he has raised issues that make one scratch one's head, then making the persuasive argument, it's more than a prima facie case, it's more than a burden of production, but it's at preponderance of the evidence in the light most favorable to, it's not much more than those things. And it's my impression that for a hearing under 590, I think it's 04, that burden was met. And then the rest of it can be addressed at the post-conviction hearing when you've got people under oath, when you can cross-examine the person alleging, whether it's a doctor or the person on the medication.
That raises another good point. This is being raised in light of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, mm-hmm. which is actually an additional burden, because with that type of claim, you've got a very high burden. We assume that the attorney did provide effective assistance of counsel. We don't assume, even in a post-conviction hearing, that the attorney provided deficient counsel.
Yeah, there's a weird circularity to this position, and I admit that I wrestled with whether to foreground the PPCR or the ineffective assistance and went with the one with the lower burden. Yes, the Strickland standard for ineffective assistance of counsel is a very high burden, and as a trial attorney, I'm glad it should be. The record, all the trial court needs or is allowed to do in a situation like this is to determine whether the petition raises enough of, whether the petition satisfies the burden by preponderance of the evidence that there is some likelihood of achieving the higher burden of the Strickland standard. So if Mr. Reinhart in this case merited a post-conviction hearing, well, then we can find out. And maybe the district court judge felt pretty strongly, and maybe he was right, that after the hearing, he would have said, no, you haven't met the Strickland standard. Maybe true. But you don't get to deny the hearing because you've already decided that nothing that can come out at the hearing is going to say, I'm sorry. If you decide nothing that could come out of the hearing is going to satisfy the standard, then that is the burden. You absolutely can't deny the hearing. But if you decided, yeah, no, I don't think so, then no. Sorry to the court reporter on that one. But then no, you don't get to deny the hearing before you hear the evidence. And again, the PPCR, the post-conviction relief burden, is low enough that Mr. Reinhart met it. He surpassed it, and he gets to go to district court and make the arguments.
I think that's where you get tripped up a little bit, though, is because it is in light of the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. It's not just a claim of didn't make the plea intelligently, which I think would fall under the preponderance standard, preponderance of the evidence standard alone. But now you've got.
Sure. The something standard, I missed the word.
The preponderance of the evidence standard, but you do have the additional burden of showing that counsel provided ineffective assistance of counsel, and we don't assume that. So you've got that additional burden, it seems, that you have to overcome here.
But I don't think the petitioner in a post-conviction petition needs to meet the manifest injustice standard. That's plea withdrawal. Needs to meet the Strickland standard fully, needs to meet and surpass the Strickland standard.
No, it doesn't need. He doesn't need to meet or surpass, but he needs to provide evidence to show
that he might.
That's a reasonable probability that he can show that the attorney engaged in ineffective assistance of counsel.
And again, I never once in my brief, nor did Mr. Reinhardt in his affidavit, suggest that trial counsel forged his signature.
Well, but that's not an issue.
That's
not the issue here. The issue that I want to focus on is the two issues that you are arguing of the under the influence of medication and the letter from counsel.
Well, and that's and the ineffective assistance, I believe, was the burden that Your Honor was suggesting I have to meet, or at least confront. And if, in fact, that letter was not sent, and Mr. Reinhardt didn't understand it. Mr. Reinhardt didn't understand it. Then I think he's confronted that Strickland standard. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes as well. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin whenever you are ready.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Buskey. I am an assistant Wright County attorney here today on behalf of respondent, State of Minnesota. Appellant pled guilty to two counts of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, and he admitted that he had anal sex with two children under the age of 13. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied appellant an evidentiary hearing regarding his petition for post-conviction relief. Appellant courts review the denial of post-conviction relief for abuse of discretion, and an abuse of discretion is present if a decision is based on an erroneous view of the law or is against logic and the facts in the record. In this case, the post-conviction court's decision followed the law, was logical, and was supported by the facts in the record. In the post-conviction court's February 2023 order, the post-conviction court used the correct standard in determining whether to grant an evidentiary hearing. The post-conviction court said, quote, the standard for granting an evidentiary hearing is, and then cited and quoted Minnesota Statute 590.04, Subdivision 1. Now, the post-conviction court acknowledged that it needs to consider the facts in the light most favorable to the petitioner, and it also acknowledged that it needs to resolve any doubts about whether or not an evidentiary hearing should be conducted in favor of the petitioner. But the post-conviction court also correctly noted that the petition must allege more than argumentative assertions without factual support.
Well, I mean, the facts are that he was said a cap of 288 months, and he can argue for a departure. Now, in all fairness, it didn't say a prison cap of 288 months. And isn't it possible that the departure was going to be a downward, well, in his mind, I guess he had already gotten the dispositional departure. He was going to get probation. So isn't it possible that that when it says argue for departure, it could have meant a downward durational departure of less than 288 months hanging over his head? Is that conceivable?
I think it's conceivable that appellant's trial counsel could have argued for less than 288 months of prison time. However, the record is abundantly clear that the option of prison time was on the table under the offer that appellant took.
So there's no other way to assume that departure means anything other than downward durational?
No, I disagree with that. The trial counsel did, in fact, argue for a downward dispositional departure as well. The sentencing hearing transcript goes a lot into that detail. The respondent's position is that when we look at the June 3rd, 2020 letter from trial counsel to appellant, trial counsel explicitly told appellant that the state was offering a total of 288 months, quote, with a commit to prison, unquote. That clarity in how trial counsel explained the offer to appellant, paired with the language used in the plea petition itself and the plea hearing, makes the record abundantly clear that appellant knew he was facing potential prison time.
And there's no dispute he got this letter.
I argue there's no dispute. I mean, he signed the letter. He signed under the part where it says that he was acknowledging he has been fully informed of the state's offer and of the risk of proceeding to trial. Now, appellant's counsel brought up today that respondent stated in its brief, it seemed like appellant was claiming it may not be his signature. Respondent got that out of the language in appellant's affidavit where he said that he did not recognize the letter and that the signature appeared to be his, but he didn't say in his affidavit that it was. The respondent is not raising a fact
issue. I'm sorry, that it was or wasn't his signature?
The respondent's position is that it is his signature. Nothing in the record shows that it's not. Appellant argues that it appears to be his signature. But again, other than his self-serving statement that he, you know, didn't read the letter or that it only appears to be his signature, the rest of the record shows that he did, in fact, review that letter and was aware of the offer.
Does the record indicate he got the PSI, or does the record indicate he got it and read it?
For the PSI prepared by Agent Miller, yes. The record indicates that he got it and read it. In the sentencing hearing transcript,
And that PSI says 288 months commit to prison.
Yes. The PSI writer was recommending a commit to prison. If I recall correctly, I think that PSI writer actually recommended more than 288 months as a commit to prison.
Based on aggravating factors?
Yeah.
Potential aggravating factors?
Yes. Either that or even trying to give an additional criminal history point for count six.
At the hearing... At the hearing where Reinhardt's counsel was arguing, was his argument for a departure, was his argument solely based on less time in prison? I mean, did he say, at this time, Your Honor, we're asking that he not be sentenced to 288 months in prison, that he should get, you know, 100 months in prison? Did he say something like that on the record?
No, that's not what trial counsel argued at sentencing.
What did he argue at sentencing?
He argued for a downward dispositional departure.
Of no jail time whatsoever. And to be on probation?
He was seeking probation, and I believe he also suggested a six-month jail or EHM sentence.
As a condition of probation?
Yes. If I could go back to Your Honor's question about how we know that appellant had an opportunity to read the PSI. In the sentencing hearing transcript, district court asked trial counsel if, you know, all of the parties had received the PSI. Trial counsel said yes. And then district court asked trial counsel if he had had an opportunity to review the PSI with his client, and trial counsel said yes.
And there was another PSI done, correct?
Yes, there was an alternative. The record calls it an alternative PSI done by a dispositional advisor. Trial counsel arranged for that alternative PSI.
Was there anything in there about prison?
Yes. In the alternative PSI, Ms. Butler, the author, indicated that Mr. Reinhardt expressed concerns about whether he would be able to follow the rules of prison. If he didn't know that possible prison time was on the table, he would have had no reason to bring up concerns about whether or not he could follow prison rules.
But isn't that really, can that be interpreted as speaking in the alternative of if he did go to prison versus he will likely go to prison?
If he says, if I go to prison, he's acknowledging the fact that he knew a prison commit was a possibility. The offer was for a cap of 288 months of prison with the ability to argue for a departure. It's possible the trial court could have sentenced him to no prison under that offer, but the record shows that appellant was aware that it was also possible the district court could send him to prison for up to 288 months.
I want to make sure I understand the record. So it's my understanding, tell me if this is correct. So this was the offer that he initially rejected. 288 months, argue for departure. And he said no. Is that correct?
In the June 3rd, 2020 letter, the offer was for 288 months of prison with a commit to prison. At the plea hearing, then we see the...
Turn that down.
Correct. He rejected that on the record on June 5th, 2020, the day after he signed that letter. Then when we get to the plea hearing and the plea petition in June of 2021, we see the language still about the 288 months, but there it's capped, and he's given the opportunity to argue for a departure.
And theoretically, that's what he accepted?
Yes. But when we read the June 2020 letter from trial counsel to appellant, and then also read in conjunction with the plea petition and the plea hearing transcript, he knew we were talking about 288 months of prison as the maximum possibility under the offer. The files and the records of the proceeding also show that appellant's trial counsel acted within an objective standard of reasonableness at the time of sentencing. On appeal, appellant was arguing that trial counsel should have called sentencing witnesses or otherwise approached sentencing differently. The record shows appellant's trial counsel made arrangements for that alternative PSI. Trial counsel obtained a letter in support of appellant from his employer and provided it to the district court prior to sentencing. And appellant's trial counsel made a thoughtful argument in support of a departure. The record is clear that trial counsel had a strategy for sentencing. An appellant's claim now that trial counsel should have called witnesses or done something different is exactly the type of hindsight is 20/20 second guessing that Strickland would prohibit.
Didn't the district court, though, say that they were going to set aside the whole afternoon, anticipating that there were going to be affidavits, there's going to be testimony? In other words, we're going to need a sufficient amount of time for appellant to be able to present his case. And that didn't happen. It was just appellant's attorney's trial counsel's arguments and then a brief statement that he read from appellant himself.
I recall that section of the plea hearing transcript a little bit differently. I agree with Your Honor that the district court offered to set aside an entire afternoon for the sentencing, at least in part, so appellant would have time to call witnesses if he wanted to. My recollection is also that the district court wanted to set aside that much time so there would be time for victim impact statements. The court did hear from heard three victim impact statements. One of them was from one of the minor children himself. It was only about a sentence long. And then there were also two adult family members that spoke. I appreciate that the trial counsel was willing to dedicate so much time to the sentencing hearing. The state appreciates that there was sufficient time for victim impact statements. However, just because that time is there doesn't mean that trial counsel had to fill it with statements from appellant's friends or family members. The information that trial counsel had already provided by way of the alternative PSI, the letter in support of the employer, and trial counsel's argument for the departure, along with appellant's prepared statement at sentencing, shows that trial counsel was acting under an objective standard of reasonableness.
So just that I'm absolutely clear, at the sentencing hearing, appellant's counsel was arguing for a dispositional departure.
Yes.
Okay.
That's how I interpret that portion of the transcript. Appellant's trial counsel talked about factors like appellant's alleged remorse and things like that, showing that he was particularly amenable to probation. Now, respondent takes issue with the claim that appellant is remorseful. I note that in the PSI,
I want to get back to. So, he said at the hearing, you know, Your Honor, I'm asking you not to send him to prison. I'm asking you to place him on probation. Did he say that?
Yes. If I could have just a moment, I'll pull up that portion of the transcript here. So starting on page 24 of the sentencing hearing transcript, Mr. Jones discusses the TROG factors which relate to amenability to probation, so falling under a dispositional departure. When I look at
all right, but he's going to say he doesn't understand the TROG factors. What I'm looking for in the transcript, and we'll have to check it out, is, I mean, if Mr. Reinhardt all along is assuming he's going to get probation, and that was what it was going to be, but at the hearing the lawyer is asking for probation, then I would think Mr. Reinhardt, a reasonable person would say, well, I'm already getting probation, so why are you arguing for probation? So what I'm looking for this transcript is saying, don't send him to prison, he should get probation. Now, if I look at the transcript, I mean, and in a simple, basic language like that, not the TROG factors, not he's amenable, not he's remorseful, but I'm arguing that you shouldn't send him to prison, Your Honor, he should get probation. Will I find that in the transcript?
I don't think you'll find a specific quote from trial counsel that says, don't send him to prison. I do think you'll find clear language from trial counsel indicating that appellant was requesting a local jail sanction or work release, which obviously couldn't happen if he was in prison. Going back to the plea hearing, at one point trial counsel said, if you're committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, unquote, again, that's pretty clear that the possibility of prison was on the table. Even looking at the language
who's
of
saying that? Who is
trial
saying?
Counsel.
Okay, fine.
Even if we look at the language of the petition itself and the plea hearing, trial counsel clearly talked about a 288-month cap on prison time, or cap on months, and then also talked about the ability to argue for a departure. Argue, not that a departure was guaranteed.
Thank you, Colin. So if you want to summarize quickly.
Thank you. I see my light was red. Trial counsel was effective, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in any of its orders. Therefore, the respondent asks that you affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Counsel began by saying that this court reviews the decision to deny the post-conviction petition under an abuse of discretion standard. I think we'll all agree that the legal issues would be reviewed under a de novo standard. And the order denying post-conviction relief on page 6, about the middle of page 6, starts off by saying the Strickland test identifies two prongs, and he goes into the Strickland test. And I don't see that he says, and my job here in affirming or denying the petition is to decide whether you've established a preponderance of the evidence that with further hearing, evidentiary hearing, we might meet that. The district court applied the Strickland test. That's the wrong test. That's too high a burden for whether or not to give a post-conviction hearing.
But on page 5 of that order that you just referenced, it says petitioner has the burden of establishing by a fair preponderance of the evidence. So the post-conviction court is indeed applying the proper standard, but it's not just that standard because the claim is being brought under an ineffective assistance of counsel, which is guided by and determined by Strickland. So I don't see how that's inconsistent.
With 5 minutes, we don't have time to read the whole order, but if we go to page 11, district court judge says that this court concludes petitioner has not asserted facts that, if proven, would overcome his counsel's performance, and then states the Strickland standard. Again, I think that's challenging him to meet the Strickland burden on the post-conviction petition.
Right, in light of the standard of presenting evidence by proponents of the evidence that he could indeed meet the Strickland factor. I want to switch gears a little bit. Looking at the plea petition itself, there's language in there that there's a paragraph in there that states that, quote, the maximum penalty that the court could impose for this crime, parentheses, taking into consideration any prior conviction or convictions and parent, is imprisonment for 30 years. That seems pretty clear, and that's in the plea petition itself.
And that's the pre-printed part of the Rule 15 petition. You know, one of the things I've learned...
And appellant signed that petition, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and reviewed it. Okay. The second question, because we really didn't get to this before, is it appears that you're bringing two claims that trial counsel provided ineffective assistance to counsel, the second being the sentencing arguments. And if I understand your argument appeal to us correctly, is that trial counsel should have presented witnesses, should have provided testimony from appellant, did not, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't that trial strategy? And if it's trial strategy, we generally don't review trial strategy.
Yeah, and first of all, I made a misstatement in my brief, which counsel correctly caught, when I said that he limited his comments to a couple sentences. That was just wrong, and I apologize for that. I was wrong.
And we appreciate that acknowledgement.
This court gives deference, great deference, to trial strategy. In fact, absolute deference, I think. Although the question of whether failing to call any witnesses was strategy or was simply a dereliction of duty are different issues. So if he decided, hey, there's no benefit to this, it's just going to annoy the court, or whatever strategic rationale trial counsel may have come up with, that's one thing.
But isn't that, in fact, what trial counsel did? Trial counsel said, I'm not going to belabor the point. You already have the PSI, you have the alternative PSI, you have the affidavits, you have all the documents. I believe that trial counsel even said that on the record. I'm not going to belabor that. That seems to be a fairly sound trial strategy. Basically, you know, I'm not going to beat a dead horse. You have the information. I want to focus on the key issues here as to why my client should not have any jail time whatsoever and should only be on probation.
What's the question there? He did say, yeah, there's a record in front of Your Honor, and I'm going to not focus too much on the stuff that's already there. But the purpose of the post-conviction hearing is to ask him whether he did that as a deliberate strategic effort or whether it was a matter of he just didn't do it because he didn't get around to it. I don't want to make allegations that I can't support. That's the purpose of the post-conviction hearing. My red light's been flashing for a minute. I would ask this court to... We've got lots of questions here. We've asked lots of questions. We've tried to answer them. I would ask this court to remand to the district court for a reconsideration of the post-conviction denial. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel. Thank you for the conversation and trying to clarify the issues here for us. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is our last oral argument for our calendar today. We have three cases set for our non-oral calendar, so this court is in recess for those. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
All rise.